Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Well, this week we're digging back into the archives and doing a greatest hit show number 4, a collection of articles from previous episodes. Well, first up from the Washington Post, hospital alarms prove a noisy misery for patients. I feel like I'm in jail. Tens of thousands of alarms shriek, beep, and buzz every day in every U.S. hospital. All sound urgent, but few require immediate attention or get it. Intended to keep patients safe by alerting nurses to potential problems, they also create a riot of disturbances for patients trying to heal and get some rest. Nearly every machine in a hospital is now outfitted with an alarm. Infusion pumps, ventilators, bedside monitors tracking blood pressure, heart activity, and a drop in oxygen in the blood. Even beds are alarmed to detect movement that might portend a fall. The glut of noise means that the medical staff is less likely to respond. Alarms have ranked as one of the top 10 health technological hazards every year since 2007, according to the research firm ECRI Institute. This could mean staffs were too swamped with alarms to notice a patient in distress, or that the alarms were misconfigured. The Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals, warned the nation about the frequent and persistent problem of alarm safety in 2013. It now requires hospitals to create formal processes to tackle alarm safety issues. But there is no national data on whether progress has been made in reducing the prevalence of false and unnecessary alarms. The commission has estimated that of the thousands of alarms going off throughout a hospital every day, an estimated 85 to 99% do not require clinical intervention. Staff facing widespread alarm fatigue can miss critical alerts, leading to patient deaths. Patients may get anxious about fluctuations in heart rate or blood pressure that are perfectly normal. In bed alarms, a recent arrival can lead to immobility and dangerous loss of muscle mass when patients are terrified that any movement will set off the bleeps. In the past 30 years, the number of medical devices that generate alarms has risen from about 10 to nearly 40, said Priyanka Shah, a senior project engineer at ECRI Institute. A breathing ventilator alone can emit 30 to 40 different noises, she said. In addition to triggering bed alarms, patients who move in bed may set off false alarms from pulse oximeters, which measure the oxygen in a patient's blood, or carbon dioxide monitors, which measure the level of the gas in someone's breath. Maria Savak, an alarm expert and director of policy management and integration for Johns Hopkins Health System, found that one step-down unit, a level below intensive care in the hospital, an average of 350 alarms went off per patient per day from the cardiac monitor alone. She said no international standard exists for what these alarms sound like, so they vary by manufacturer and device. It's really impossible for the staff to identify by sound everything they hear, she said. The flood of alarms creates a cry wolf phenomenon, she said. The alarms are constantly calling for help. The staff look at them, they say that's just a false alarm, and they ignore the real alarm. Bed alarms, for example, are meant to summon nurses so they can supervise patients to walk safely, but research has shown that the use of alarms doesn't prevent falls. Nursing staffs are often stretched thin and don't reach the bedside before a patient hits the ground. Meanwhile, patients may feel immobilized at a time when even a few hundred steps per day could significantly improve their recovery. Immobility in the hospital can create other problems for patients, leaving them with often irreversible functional decline, research has shown. They're loud. For some patients, it's frightening. They don't know where it's coming from. It's a source of irritation, she said. For some patients, they won't move. Meanwhile, some hospitals are trying to quiet the noise. By customizing alarm settings and converting some audible alerts to visual displays at nurses' stations, Savak's team at Johns Hopkins reduced the average number of alarms from each patient's cardiac monitor from 350 to about 40 per day, she said. But that's just one device in one unit. Other devices and types of care require different customized settings. Wow. Well, that all lends to support. One of my favorite sayings is that hospital is no place for a sick person. Next up, from the American Heart Association. Long work hours at the office linked to both regular and hidden high blood pressure. Office workers who spend long hours on the job are more likely to have high blood pressure, including a type that can go undetected during a routine medical appointment, according to a new study published today in the American Heart Association's journal Hypertension. High blood pressure affects nearly half of Americans age 18 and older and is a primary factor in more than 82,000 deaths per year. Approximately 15 to 30% of U.S. adults have a type of the condition called masked hypertension, meaning their high blood pressure readings are normal during healthcare visits but elevated when measured elsewhere. Working 49 or more hours each week was linked to a 70% greater likelihood of having masked hypertension and a 66% greater likelihood of having sustained hypertension, elevated blood pressure readings in and out of clinical settings. Working between 41 and 48 hours each week was linked with a 54% greater likelihood of having masked hypertension and a 42% greater likelihood of having sustained hypertension. The findings accounted for variables such as job strain, age, sex, education level, occupation, smoking status, body mass index, and other factors. From the Washington Post, every American family basically pays an $8,000 poll tax under the U.S. health system, top economists say. America's sky-high healthcare costs are so far above what people pay in other countries that they are equivalent to a hefty tax, Princeton University economists Ann Case and Angus Deaton say. They are surprised Americans aren't revolting against these taxes. A few people are getting very rich at the expense of the rest of us, Case said at a conference in San Diego. The U.S. healthcare system is like a tribute to a foreign power, but we're doing it to ourselves. The U.S. healthcare system is the most expensive in the world, costing about $1 trillion more per year than the next most expensive system, Switzerland's. That means U.S. households pay an extra $8,000 per year compared to what a Swiss family pays. Case and Deaton view this extra cost as a poll tax, meaning it is levied on every individual regardless of their ability to pay. Most Americans think of a poll tax as money people once had to pay to register to vote, but poll was an archaic German word for head. The idea behind a poll tax is that it falls on every head. Despite paying $8,000 more a year than anyone else, American families do not have better health outcomes. Life expectancy in the United States is lower than in Europe. We can brag we have the most expensive health care. We can also now brag that it delivers the worst health of any rich country. Case and Deaton, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, made the critical remarks about U.S. health care during a talk at the American Economic Association's annual meeting, where thousands of economists gathered to discuss the health of the U.S. economy and their latest research on what's working and what's not. The two economists have risen to prominence in recent years for their work on America's, quote, deaths of despair. They discovered Americans between the ages of 25 and 64 have been committing suicide, overdosing on opioids, or dying from alcohol-related problems like liver disease at skyrocketing rates since 2000. These deaths of despair have been especially large among white Americans without college degrees as job options have rapidly declined for them. Their forthcoming book, Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism, includes a scathing chapter examining how the U.S. healthcare system has played a key role in these deaths. The authors call out pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, device manufacturers, and doctors for their roles in driving up costs and creating an opioid epidemic. In the research looking at the taxing nature of the U.S. healthcare system compared with others, Deaton is especially critical of U.S. doctors, pointing out that 16% of people in the top 1% of income earners are physicians, according to research by Williams College professor John Bakaji and others. We have half as many physicians per head as most European countries, yet they get paid 2 times as much on average, Deaton said in an interview. Physicians are a giant rent-seeking conspiracy that's taking money away from the rest of us, and yet everybody loves physicians. You can't touch them. After looking at other health systems around the world that deliver better health outcomes, the academics say it's clear that 2 things need to happen in the United States. Everyone needs to be in the health system, via insurance or a government-run system like Medicare for All, and there must be cost controls, including price caps on drugs and government decisions not to cover some procedures. From Yale University, Eco-Psychology, How Immersion in Nature Benefits Your Health. How long does it take to get a dose of nature high enough to make people say they feel healthy and have a strong sense of well-being? In a study of 20,000 people, a team led by Matthew White of the European Center for Environment and Human Health at the University of Exeter found that people who spent 2 hours a week in green spaces, that is, local parks or other natural environments, either all at once or spaced over several visits, were substantially more likely to report good health and psychological well-being than those who don't. 2 hours was a hard boundary. The study showed there were no benefits for people who didn't meet that threshold. The effects were robust, cutting across different occupations, ethnic groups, people from rich and poor areas, and people with chronic illnesses and disabilities. It's well known that getting outdoors in nature can be good for people's health and well-being. But until now, we've not been able to say how much is enough. 2 hours a week is hopefully a realistic target for many people, especially given that it can be spread over an entire week to get the benefit. The study by White and his colleagues is only the latest in a rapidly expanding area of research that finds nature has robust effects on people's health, physically, mentally, and emotionally. Studies have shown that time in nature, as long as people feel safe, is an antidote for stress. It can lower blood pressure and stress hormone levels, reduce nervous system arousal, enhance immune system function, increase self-esteem, reduce anxiety, and improve mood. Attention deficit disorder and aggression lessen in natural environments, which also helps speed the rate of healing. In a recent study, psychiatric unit researchers found that being in nature reduced feelings of isolation, promoted calm, and lifted mood among patients. The growing body of research, combined with an intuitive understanding that nature is vital and increased concerns about the exploding use of smartphones and other forms of technology, has led to a tipping point at which health experts, researchers, and government officials are now proposing widespread changes aimed at bringing nature into people's everyday lives. For example, researchers and policymakers now talk about park deserts in urban areas. Cities are adding or enhancing parks, and schools and other institutions are being designed with large windows and access to trees and green space, or blue space, as in aquatic environments. Peter Kahn, a professor of psychology at the University of Washington, who has worked on these issues for decades, is encouraged by the new focus on the subject, but concerned that the growing interest is more contact with nature relies too much on only experiencing it visually. That's important, but an impoverished view of what it means to interact with the natural world, he said. We need to deepen the forms of interaction with nature and make it more immersive. What are the active ingredients in a dose of nature? Pioneers in this work, Rachel and Stephen Kaplan, who began studying the subject in the 70s, devised attention restoration theory, which holds that paying attention in bustling cities, at work, or in other stressful environments requires a good deal of effortful attention. In a natural environment, however, the Kaplans found that people paid attention more broadly in a less effortful way, which leads to a far more relaxed body and mind. Japanese researchers have studied forest bathing, a poetic name for walking in the woods. They suspect aerosols from the forest inhaled during a walk are behind elevated levels of natural killer, or NK cells, in the immune system, which fight tumors and infections. A subsequent study in which essential oils from cedars were emitted in a hotel room where people slept also caused a significant spike in NK cells. We have entered the urban century, with 2/3 of humanity projected to be living in cities by 2050, said Gretchen Daly, director of the Natural Capital Project at Stanford University and a senior author of a recent paper arguing that the cognitive and emotional benefits of nature should be factored into economic ecosystem service models. There is an awakening underway today to many of the values of nature and the risks and costs of its loss. This new work can help inform investments in livability and sustainability of the world's cities. Understanding nature's therapeutic effects may be arriving at a propitious moment. Some studies have found that anxiety over climate change is a growing phenomenon. Ironically, one of the best antidotes for that might be a dose of green space. If I am feeling depressed and anxious and worried about the environment, Weber said, then one of the best things I can do is go out in nature. There's a prescription for health for you. Okay, I wanted to start with a couple stories that'll give us some insights into nutrition. The first one from nutritionfacts.org is why drinking diet soda makes you crave sugar. And this is a pretty good example of how when we do something that's unnatural, oftentimes it kind of fools our body and ends up not even necessarily being a net good. We're not really smarter than our body. We try to outsmart it a lot of times, but a lot of times it doesn't work. So here goes, why drinking diet soda makes you crave sugar. The problem with artificial sweeteners is that a disconnect ultimately develops between the amount of sweetness the brain tastes and how much glucose or blood sugar ends up coming to the brain. The brain feels cheated and figures you have to eat more and more and more sweetness in order to get any calories out of it. So as a consequence, at the end of the day, your brain says, okay, at some point I need some glucose or blood sugar. I need it here. And then you eat an entire cake because nobody can hold out in the end. If people are given Sprite Zero, a zero-calorie soda, or unsweetened carbonated lemon-lime water, but aren't told which drink they're getting or what the study is about, when they are later offered a choice of M&Ms, spring water, or sugar-free gum, who do you think picks the M&Ms? Those who drank the artificially sweetened soda were nearly three times more likely to take the candy than those who consumed either the sugar-sweetened or unsweetened drinks. So it wasn't a matter of sweet versus non-sweet or calories versus no calories. There's something about non-caloric sweeteners that somehow tricks the brain. The researchers did another study in which everyone was given Oreos and were then asked how satisfied the cookies made them feel. Once again, those who drank the artificially sweetened Sprite Zero reported feeling less satisfied than those who drank the regular Sprite or the sparkling water. These results are consistent with recent brain imaging studies demonstrating that regular consumption of artificial sweeteners can alter the neural pathways responsible for the hedonic or pleasure response to food. Indeed, the only way to really prevent the problem, to break the addiction, is to go completely cold turkey and go off all sweeteners, artificial as well as fructose, table sugar, and high fructose corn syrup. Eventually, the brain resets itself and you don't crave it as much. We've always assumed that consumption of both sugar and artificial sweeteners may be changing our palates or taste preferences over time, increasing our desire for sweet foods. Unfortunately, the data on this were lacking until now. 20 people agreed to cut out all added sugars and artificial sweeteners for 2 weeks. Afterwards, 95% found that sweet foods and drinks tasted sweeter or too sweet, and said moving forward they would use less or even no sugar. What's more, most stopped craving sugar within the first week, after only 6 days. This suggests a 2-week sugar challenge, or even a 1-week challenge, may help to reset taste preferences and make consuming less or no sugar easier. Perhaps we should be recommending it to our patients. Eating fewer processed foods and choosing more real, whole, and plant-based foods make it easy to consume less sugar, or at least easier. Okay, next up, this from Conscien Health, another nutrition-related story. This one, low carb or slow carbs? Fiber matters. In the midst of popular frenzy about low-carb diets, substantial evidence suggests a shift in focus to us. Research is suggesting that slow carbs might be a very good option. Soluble fiber slows the digestion of carbohydrates. It gives food a lower glycemic index, meaning it produces less of a spike in blood sugar. Fiber can also have helpful effects on gut microbes. So thus it makes sense that new studies are confirming fiber can be helpful for managing weight, also for reducing the risk of chronic diseases. Viscous fiber is a type of soluble fiber that forms a gel when it dissolves in the gut. In the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Elena Javanowski and colleagues have a new paper documenting the value of such fiber. They find it can help people lose weight, even without calorie restriction. The authors concluded, dietary viscous fiber modestly yet significantly improved body weight and other parameters of adiposity, independently of calorie restriction. Alongside this paper, Mads Jorth and Arne Astrup suggest that this effect may be due to more than the effect of the fiber on glucose and insulin responses to food. Recent evidence suggests that most of the health effects observed in response to dietary fibers are mediated via the composition of the microbiota. In a series of systematic reviews and meta-analyses last year, Bostjanjatsky et al. Found broad implications for health outcomes. They published their findings in Lancet, where they wrote, "Clinical trials show significantly lower body weight, systolic blood pressure, and total cholesterol when comparing higher with lower intakes of dietary fiber. Risk reduction associated with the range of critical outcomes was greatest when daily intake of dietary fiber was between 25 grams and 29 grams. Dose response curves suggest that higher intakes of dietary fiber could confer even greater benefit to protect against cardiovascular diseases, type 2 diabetes, and colorectal and breast cancer. Similar findings for whole grain intake were observed. From all this, we have good reason to think that perhaps the quality of the carbs we eat is just as important as the quantity. Some of the energy that goes into chasing a low-carb diet might do more good if it went into slow carbs, meaning more soluble and viscous fiber." Now, this is interesting because this last study, they basically topped out their dose of dietary fiber around 25 to 30 grams, which is about double what the average American intake is, which is around 15 grams a day. But that's actually not a very high intake. If you look back in human history with the diets that people ate, you know, when people were eating a whole food, largely plant-based diet through most of human existence, I mean, 100 grams was not unusual. In fact, I would think that if you want the most simple technique perhaps to go on a diet, I might suggest a 50-gram fiber a day diet, because this basically moves you wholesale into whole plant foods and naturally limits the amount of animal foods, which aren't as healthy and also tend to be a lot fattier and have saturated fats versus unsaturated fats. Next up, a long piece from the Environmental Health Network about chemicals in our environment. Reading, I am Pete Myers, the founder and chief scientist of Environmental Health Sciences, a nonprofit launched in Charlottesville, Virginia, that publishes environmental health news and engages in scientific research and outreach to help the public and policymakers understand that we have many opportunities to prevent diseases and disabilities that are afflicting our families, friends, and neighbors today. We can accomplish this by acting upon today's scientific understanding that chemical exposures are contributing to those problems. I'm going to let you in on a scientific reality that is going to transform the chemical enterprise and upend today's unscientific approach to figuring out what's safe and what is not. The safe dose of one of the biggest volume chemicals in the world, bisphenol A, or BPA, will have to be reduced by at least 20,000-fold. This calculation is based upon data the U.S. Food and Drug Administration obtained in an ambitious, roughly $30 million collaborative program called Clarity BPA. Clarity was designed to reconcile differences between traditional regulatory science as practiced by the FDA and results obtained by independent academic scientists funded by the NIH, the Environmental Health Sciences. Many scientific effects were observed at the lowest dose tested, including data obtained by the FDA. That means take today's FDA reference dose and divide by at least 20,000. That's the highest exposure that would be considered safe if regulated according to existing scientific understanding. The chemical would disappear from any uses that bring it into contact with food or drinking water, human skin, or result in it evaporating into the air or melting into water. The same would hold true for many other chemicals that disrupt hormone signaling, that is, endocrine disrupting chemicals, which have been linked to multiple health impacts including prostate cancer, breast cancer, infertility, diabetes, attention deficit disorder, and autism. Maybe not all endocrine disrupting chemicals require a 20,000-fold reduction, perhaps only a 1,000-fold, but there are at least several hundred endocrine disrupting chemicals in use today that could follow this pattern. All would see greatly heightened restrictions on their uses, and that represents an existential threat to the chemical industry. I am not anti-chemical or anti-chemist. We need chemicals, including plastics, to make modern civilization work. What we need, however, is to do a much better job designing the next generation of inherently safer materials, safer than the mix we have today, which has been deployed with far too little attention to its inherent toxicity. I've spent a significant part of my work over the last decade helping chemists design safer chemicals. I want to help them grab market share in the booming demand for safer materials. I want to help them make money. Some people claim that chemical regulations stifle innovation. Just the opposite is true. It will require tremendous innovation to move away from hazardous chemicals and towards materials that are safer. It can be done. The scientific knowledge we possess today about what causes chemical harm is deep and wide, so much better than what we knew when hazardous materials in widespread use today were designed. Let's use that knowledge to innovate. What's the long-term landscape? A series of events and scientific discoveries over the past two decades are revealing that not only have long-standing chemical industry practices harmed people's health, investors taking positions in chemical companies may be exposing their wealth to unexpected and large financial risks. These risks arise from a core reality of the business of establishing what is safe and what is not. Chemicals are not thoroughly tested, if at all, for safety before being released into the market, resulting in widespread, if not universal, exposure, including to highly vulnerable populations like babies still in the womb. Serious harmful effects often are not detected until decades later. All too often, as effects are discovered, the responsible party, which made the initial mistake to incorporate a poorly understood chemical in products and take them to global scale, doubles down in efforts to hide or dismiss concerns about safety, using toolkits to manufacture doubt developed by the tobacco and lead industries. Internal memos obtained through legal discovery reveal that the companies, sometimes decades earlier, had ignored or hidden scientific evidence that raised safety concerns. Three prominent examples emerged in the past few years alone: Monsanto Bayer and the Roundup herbicide, Johnson & Johnson with asbestos in its talc baby powder, and 3M and DuPont with their manufacture and use of perfluorinated Teflon-related forever chemicals, PFAS. Thousands of lawsuits are being heard against those companies now. Shareholder values plummet as juries reach decisions. Billions of dollars at stake. And there will be more. Monsanto had earned a bad rap for misbehavior with its chemicals for decades, but Johnson & Johnson, 3M, and DuPont didn't. They had been widely regarded as good corporate citizens. If even they have laundry this dirty in their past, how many other companies have pursued similar practices? Unquestionably many. But with the practices so widespread, perhaps a pertinent question is, can any company within this sector be presumed innocent? It's just too common a business practice. It's standard operating procedure. Another example, Bill Moyer's 2001 documentary Trade Secrets unveiled an early 1970s conspiracy by several seemingly respected chemical companies to hide devastating scientific discoveries about the health risks of vinyl chloride, one of the most important chemicals for the plastics industry. The conspiracy involved Conoco, B.F. Goodrich, Dow, Shell, Ethylene Union Carbide, some of the founding fathers of the chemical revolution. A new weapon against these bad practices has emerged and matured since the tobacco settlements of the late 1980s. The creation of large searchable databases of internal documents obtained through legal discovery and lawsuits, showing that the companies knew what they knew and when they knew it, and also how they conspired with federal agencies to derail needed safety regulations. The two biggest databases are the Chemical Industry Documents Library at the University of California, San Francisco, and ToxicDocs, a similar database of 20 million internal documents dating back as far as 1920, hosted by Columbia University and City University of New York. The University of California, San Francisco Library now includes a large set of documents released by the Attorney General of Minnesota upon settlement of an $850 million suit against 3M last February. The lawsuits currently underway against Monsanto, Bayer, 3M, and Johnson & Johnson will undoubtedly add additional documents to provide yet more evidence of cover-ups that commenced long ago. It already is a positive feedback loop. As new documents add to the body of evidence, which will stimulate more lawsuits, financial risks arise for chemical industry investments from a different direction as well. The advance of science demonstrating harm and the evolution of science to determine what is safe. The discovery of harm can be slow arriving, sometimes decades after a chemical is first put on the market, but impacts of harm can nonetheless be devastating. For example, 3M and DuPont's forever chemicals, perfluorinated compounds or PFAS, which degrade very slowly in the environment if at all, were first used in products in the 1940s. scientific concerns about them started to appear in the 1990s, although internal documents indicate the companies had known decades earlier. Most of the concerns have been about cancer, low birth weights, immune system function, and birth defects. Last year, a science team in Italy unveiled results revealing a new, different set of adverse impacts, this time on male reproduction. They include decreased penis size, reduced sperm count, and structural changes in the reproductive tract, classic signs of endocrine disruption. And I might add as an editorial note, in our patriarchal world, maybe what will cause a change is these chemicals decreasing penis size. Okay, on with the show. And the team's research confirmed that the contaminants interfere with testosterone action. Even without the penis effect, 3M settled that $850 million suit with the state of Minnesota. DuPont settled a case in West Virginia for $671 million. And this month, the film Dark Waters, starring Mark Ruffalo, tells the story of the company's decades-long treachery. New Hampshire, New Jersey, and New York have ongoing lawsuits. As of the end of 2019, research by the U.S. military, the Environmental Working Group, and others have documented PFAS contamination in more than 400 sites around the U.S. According to one analysis, 110 million Americans have drinking water contaminated by unsafe levels of these chemicals. This estimate is likely to grow substantially with the discovery of PFAS in artificial turf and leaching therefrom into surface water, and the haphazard disposal of untold tons of artificial turf once it wears out and must be replaced. Many other suits will unquestionably be filed, and that's just in the U.S. These chemicals have once already created furors about public health in Australia and Canada. But if there's an existential threat on the horizon for the chemical enterprise, it's the compelling evidence that two of the most basic assumptions used by regulatory agencies to determine what is safe and what is not are flat out wrong. One assumption is that it's sufficient to examine chemicals one at a time. The second bedrock assumption is that high-dose testing can be used to detect low-dose effects. These assumptions have underpinned literally every single risk assessment, what's safe and what's not, of a chemical that has ever been done anywhere in the world. One at a time fails because it doesn't acknowledge that no one is ever exposed to just one chemical at a time. We are exposed to hundreds, if not thousands. What does every physician ask a patient for whom the doc is about to prescribe a drug? What medicines are you already taking? That's because chemicals interact. One of the most ridiculous uses of this assumption is perhaps in testing pesticides. The EPA tests the, quote, active ingredient of a pesticide, yet the pesticide that is available for purchase is a mixture of dozens of chemicals, many of which are added in the product sold explicitly to enhance the impact of the active ingredient. How can you assess pesticide safety without considering the whole product, not just the active ingredient? You can't. High-dose testing falls on the sword of what endocrinologists call non-monotonicity. Many syllables, but a simple concept. Hormones and chemicals that behave like or interfere with hormones do different things at different doses. There are many examples of this in the scientific literature of endocrinology, the study of hormones. This is an anathema to traditional and regulatory toxicology, because that science maintains that the dose makes the poison, which the regulatory agencies interpret to mean higher doses have bigger effects. Environmental Health Network recruited a reporter, Lynn Peoples, to investigate the FDA's execution of the roughly $30 million project to reconcile their conclusions with the work of 14 independent academic labs showing harm at low levels for over a year. The investigation found that the FDA worked to ignore or discredit independent evidence of harm while favoring pro-industry science despite significant shortcomings. Key to their conclusions was rejecting statistically significant non-monotonic patterns in their own data because they asserted the non-monotonic findings were not biologically meaningful. In other words, non-monotonic patterns aren't real. The dose makes the poison seems like common sense, but common sense has failed us many times in the past. Think about quantum physics or plate tectonics. Our understanding of the modern world depends upon the practical implications of those discoveries. Non-monotonicity isn't nearly as revolutionary as those scientific fields, but it is profoundly important for human health and is a standard widely accepted concept in endocrinology and pharmacology. In 2012, the then director of the National Institute of Health and Environmental Health Services, Linda Birnbaum, editorialized that non-monotonicity should be the default assumption in the study of endocrine-disrupting chemicals. Unfortunately, many published scientific papers now show that doses way below the, quote, no effect dose can cause serious adverse effects. It isn't that the high doses are safer. They, too, cause problems. It's just that the effects are different. The low dose effects are serious, too, like morbid obesity and reduced fertility. Here's the one practical implication I mentioned at the beginning. If the FDA were to acknowledge statistically significant non-monotonicity in their test of BPA, which analysis by independent scientists has confirmed, the safe dose would be reduced by a factor of more than 20,000-fold. BPA would become virtually unusable. Bisphenol A is one of the plastic industry's most important molecules. Incredibly cheap to make, incredibly abundant in production, incredibly important to the bottom line, also incredibly dangerous to human health. Removing that one molecule alone would send tectonic signals throughout the chemical enterprise, and yet BPA is but one of at least 100 or more molecules that have non-monotonic patterns. The replacement chemicals for BPA, currently touted as BPA-free, are likely to be among them, although many have not been tested. BPA-free does not mean safe. Non-monotonicity is truly an existential threat to today's chemical enterprise. If that enterprise is to become sustainable, it must embrace this basic endocrinological reality. Embracing it is a path to reversing today's epidemic of chronic diseases that are driven, at least in part, by chemical hacking of the hormone messaging system by endocrine-disrupting compounds. Okay, next up from Discover Magazine, we've sequenced the human genome, so why haven't we cured more diseases? An emergency room physician, initially unable to diagnose a disoriented patient, finds on the patient a wallet-sized card providing access to his genome, or all his DNA. The physician quickly searches the genome, diagnoses the problem, and sends the patient off for a gene therapy cure. That's what a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist imagined in 2020 would look like when she reported on the Human Genome Project back in 1996. The Human Genome Project was an international scientific collaboration that successfully mapped, sequenced, and made publicly available the genetic content of the human chromosomes, or all human DNA, taking place between 1990 and 2003. The project caused many to speculate about the future of medicine. In 1996, Walter Gilbert, a Nobel laureate, said, "The results of the Human Genome Project will produce a tremendous shift in the way we do medicine and attack problems of human disease." In 2000, Francis Collins, then the head of the Human Genome Project at the National Institutes of Health, predicted, "Perhaps in another 15 or 20 years, you will see a complete transformation in therapeutic medicine." The same year, President Bill Clinton stated the Human Genome Project would, quote, "revolutionize the diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of most, if not all, human diseases." It is now 2020, and no one carries a genome card. Physicians typically do not examine your DNA to diagnose or treat you. Why not? As I explained in a recent article in the Journal of Neurogenetics, the causes of common debilitating diseases are complex, so they typically are not amenable to simple genetic treatments, despite the hope and hype to the contrary. The idea that a single gene can cause human diseases has been around for several decades. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, high-profile scientific journals, including Nature and the Journal of the American Medical Association, announced single gene causation of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and alcoholism, among other conditions and behaviors. These articles drew massive attention in the popular media, but they were soon retracted or failed attempts at replication. These reevaluations completely undermined the initial conclusions, which often had relied on misguided statistical tests. Biologists were generally aware of these developments, though the follow-up studies received little attention in popular media. There are indeed individual genetic mutations that cause devastating disorders, such as Huntington's disease, but most common debilitating diseases are not caused by a mutation of a single gene. This is because people who have a debilitating genetic disease, on average, do not survive long enough to have numerous healthy children. In other words, there is a strong evolutionary pressure against such mutations. Huntington's disease is an exception that endures because it typically does not produce symptoms until a patient is beyond their reproductive years. Although new mutations for many other disabling conditions occur by chance, they don't become frequent in the population. Instead, most common debilitating diseases are caused by combinations of mutations in many genes, each having a very small effect. They interact with one another and with environmental factors, modifying the production of proteins from genes. The many kinds of microbes that live within the human body can play a role too. Since common serious diseases are rarely caused by single gene mutations, they cannot be cured by replacing a mutated gene with a normal copy, the promise of gene therapy. Gene therapy has gradually progressed in research along a very bumpy path, which has included accidentally causing leukemia and at least one death, but doctors recently have been successful treating some rare diseases with a single gene mutation and has had a large effect. Gene therapy for rare single gene disorders is likely to succeed, but must be tailored to each individual condition. The enormous cost and the relatively small number of patients who can be helped by such a treatment may create insurmountable financial barriers in this case. For many diseases, gene therapy may never be useful. This is a good example of a general mistake, I think, that we see in science. Modern science, as it's generally practiced, is very reductionistic, looking for very narrow reasons. And by focusing on these very narrow reasons, we tend to get this idea that those kind of surgical, singular approaches are going to solve all our health problems, or even all the world's problems for that matter. This article, as it clearly states, shows that that's not really the case. In fact, I think this article even overemphasizes the amount of genetic versus environmental. Obviously, genetics is important. Maybe a quarter, a third of health is driven by genetic variations, but the vast majority is environmental. Obviously, what we eat, whether we smoke or not, the kind of environment you live in with infectious disease or in the environment, things that cause injury, these things are far more important for determining our long-term health than the genes that we happen to inherit, at least on a population base. Well, we live in an age of mass protest, and here's a very interesting article from Scientific American. What so-called less lethal weapons actually do. During the recent protests over the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other Black Americans, police forces across the country have used weapons categories as, quote, less lethal, to disperse crowds and subdue individuals. But despite their label, these tools can still overstep the inherent limitations of flesh and bone. Devices that sound innocuous, rubber bullets, tear gas, are designed to quickly change human behavior through force and chemistry, and they are sold as an alternative to the kind of force that immediately kills. Such weapons are not harmless, however. For starters, they are often used as a prelude to more severe measures, notes Stuart Schrader, an assistant research scientist in sociology at Johns Hopkins University and author of the book Badges Without Borders. One of the reasons it's a complete misnomer to call a weapon non-lethal or less lethal is if it's being used to force people into the attack range of cops with batons or soldiers with rifles, he says. In only the most strict technical reading could you call that less lethal or non-lethal. In addition to their use in combination with lethal weapons, these tools can still cause serious injury and death on their own. Such devices fall roughly into three categories. There are blunt force weapons, which are designed to hurt people with a physical impact, and chemical agents, which are meant to irritate or incapacitate. A third group comprises specialized technologies ranging from electric shocks of handheld tasers to weaponized sound waves. Blunt use of force. Police commonly carry handheld implements such as batons and shields that can be employed to injure people. During intense protests, a flashier item has long been seen widespread use, metal projectiles encased in rubber, euphemistically termed rubber bullets. From their earliest uses, these bullets have a history of causing lasting injury. While officially designated as rounds that can be fired at the ground to then bounce onto people's legs, the rubber-encased projectiles often directly hit skulls, chests, or eyes. In the 2009 study, researchers at Wayne State University found rubber bullets can hit with a force greater than 3,500 newtons, more than twice as hard as being punched in the side of the head by a professional boxer, which was enough to fracture cadaver skulls. Militaries and police have employed rubber bullets in many situations, beginning in northern Ireland in the 1970s and including Washington, D.C. this month. But they are just one example of a family of projectiles, sometimes called baton rounds, that have long been used as an alternative to standard bullets. The December 1969 issue of the FBI Law Enforcement Bulletin described one such item used by the British government for riot control in Hong Kong, then a dependent territory of the UK. The bullet had a teak shell with a small lead insert and was fired by compressed gas. Present-day wooden baton rounds are broader and more puck-shaped, and they have been used by police from Seattle to Ferguson. Beyond rubber and wood, other less lethal projectiles still in use include plastic bullets, which have also caused injuries and deaths, as well as gun-propelled satchels full of lead shot, called beanbag rounds, which incapacitate people in much the same way. In the past couple of weeks, blunt force projectiles like these have fractured skulls, broken jaws, and sent people to the hospital in critical condition. A number of people who say they have lost eyes to baton rounds while participating in or covering the George Floyd protests have indicated they are forming a support group. And a professional association of ophthalmologists has written an open letter asking police to stop using eye-damaging techniques, including rubber bullets. Chemical agency. The chemical weapons broadly termed tear gas are officially classified as lacrimatory agents because they result in tears, along with nausea, burning sensations, watering eyes, and a feeling of breathing difficulty. Thrown canisters and grenades of tear gas produce clouds of powder, an appearance akin to smoke that billow in the air like a mist. On contact with the body, the powder produces the aforementioned reaction, which incapacitate people so they cannot voluntarily resist police. One of the oldest types of tear gas is the compound CS, which was formulated in 1928 and popularized in the 1960s for two main uses: as a weapon in support of lethal action by the U.S. military in Vietnam, and as a non-lethal way to control crowds, many of them protesting police brutality and the Vietnam War itself. To call CS a riot control agent, as the military did, Schrader wrote in Badges Without Borders, was to legitimize its use in Vietnam and make it uncontroversial, despite the fact that CS was not used in riot control as much as in combat. Military studies performed in the 1950s classified CS as non-lethal, but experts today say these studies had limitations in design and applicability and should be treated with some skepticism. Tear gas is designed to disperse and irritate, but it was designed and first used in an era that it was assumed it would be used against healthy working-age males, said Dan Cazzetta, who studies protection against chemical and biological weapons and has spent some of his 30-year career in the U.S. Army's Chemical Corps and the Secret Service. Lab studies have not revealed the effects tear gas can have on other demographics or people with pre-existing conditions. There's no way to structure an ethical lab study to investigate children, asthmatics, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease sufferers, tuberculosis patients, or pregnant women, Cazzetta says. He adds that women's reactions to tear gas are also not well understood. Outside of the lab, tear gas has been shown to cause prolonged damage in people with asthma and to potentially contribute to miscarriages. It has also been linked to death when used in confined and poorly ventilated spaces. Tear gas canisters themselves can be lethal fired at protesters' head, as they were in Iraq in October-November 2019. The other most common kinds of chemical weapons used on civilians are pepper sprays. They were originally devised as an animal repellent, derived from chili plants' natural defense against mammals. Police adopted the sprays for use on humans starting in the 1980s. In theory, police manuals outline the sprays as a very short-range tool to disperse crowds or prevent immediate harm to officers, bystanders, or property. But in practice, police have also used these weapons against sitting and unarmed protesters. They can cause a burning sensation on the skin and produce similar effects to tear gas, including watering eyes and breathing difficulty. Sound machine. The long-range acoustic device, LRAD, is marketed as an alternative to police bullhorns and loudspeakers. While it is certainly capable of transmitting messages loudly, it was designed to first warn people and then incapacitate them. The device produces sound waves deliberately shaped to carry far and at a high volume. It hits a target at up to 152 decibels, enough to cause permanent hearing damage. LRADs come in a range of sizes, most often resembling a large flat speaker. They can be mounted on a tripod, but are most commonly incorporated in vehicles, including dedicated trucks and helicopters. LRAD use against protesters dates at least as early as the G20 protests in Pittsburgh in 2009. In 2014, the New York Police Department was sued for turning LRADs against protesters, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit held that, quote, purposefully using an LRAD in a manner capable of causing serious injury to move nonviolent protesters to the sidewalk violates the 14th Amendment under clearly established law. Journalist Andrew Neef, who experienced an LRAD in the Pittsburgh protest, describes the effect in a 2018 article. Your brain feels like it's vibrating in a bowl of jelly on the table, he told the Arizona Mirror. Flashbangs. Flashbang grenades, also known as stun grenades, have their origins in a hostage rescue mission supported by British Special Forces in 1977. Flashbangs exist as both hand thrown grenade-like devices, and projectiles that fit into standard 40mm grenade launchers. The flash is a sudden bright light that causes ocular pain, confusion, and temporary blindness. The bang is more than 165 decibels, louder than a shotgun. These tools are designed to incapacitate anyone nearby who is not prepared for the sound or light, and to facilitate the movement of the police or soldiers who toss them. In addition to their use as crowd control measures, police have also utilized their grenades to gain the element of surprise when entering buildings and homes by force. A protester encountering a flashbang in Seattle last month was reported to have been injured by shrapnel. And in general, police flashbangs have caused injuries and deaths, including burns and fatal heart attacks. Electronic control. Taser is a well-known brand name that has become the catch-all term for devices formerly known as electronic control weapons. They are handheld tools that launch a pair of darts designed to hook into a person's skin at a target up to 35 feet away. Thin copper wires extend from the darts back to the device, allowing the wielder to deliver a powerful electric shock. While formerly described as a less lethal alternative to explicitly lethal bullets, a 2017 Reuters investigation of more than 700 people who died after being shocked with the weapon found it to be a contributing factor in one-fifth of those deaths. Six police officers in Atlanta who used these devices on a pair of students to force them out of their car protests on May 20th have been charged for an aggressive use of force. And last up, we have an article from Scientific American that gets at the intersection of ideology and science. Awareness of our biases is essential to good science. In a recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Lawrence Krauss bemoans what he sees as contemporary science's, quote, ideological corruption. He blames this corruption on humanities scholars for pointing out how science can be tainted by ideological biases due to race, sex, or economic dominance. His complaint rests on a basic mistake. Krauss confuses what he calls ideological corruption, ideology leading science astray from facts, with ideological awareness. Ideological commitments and social and political values have always influenced scientific research. Such values can light the way for science or lead into darkness. For most of the history of medical research, studies have disproportionately focused on men. As a result, we know far less about how various ailments manifest in women and how to treat those ailments with appropriate drugs at appropriate dosages. This is a problematic influence of values, one that's had deadly outcomes. Currently, a tremendous amount of scientific research has pivoted to address different facets of COVID-19. This is a laudable shift that reflects our collective priority of managing and ultimately ending this pandemic. Science does not occur in a social vacuum, as it were. Rather, scientific research reflects the priorities, unquestioned assumptions, and blind spots of individual scientists and the broader cultures they participate in. The influence of social and political values on science only becomes problematic when one of two circumstances arise. First, pernicious values can shape scientific research, as regrettably has been the case for racism and sexism for far too much of science's history. Thus, the failure to devote proportionate attention to medical research to women's health, and the recurrent efforts over centuries to establish the biological inferiority of people of color, genetic, neural, or otherwise. Second, whether values are pernicious or positive, they can lead scientific research astray if they wield improper influence on study design, data analysis, or other elements of scientific research. A well-known example of this is when the tobacco industry funded scientific experts to conduct misleading research about cigarettes' role in lung cancer. What we fervently wish to be true, or what would enrich a corporation if it were true, should not shape scientific findings. This is why so much attention is spent ensuring the funding sources of scientific research don't improperly influence the findings. But the influence of values on scientific research is much more pervasive than these kinds of problematic instances. Scientists and society's values shape what research questions are posed, how many resources are devoted to answering those questions, what the exact aims of the research consist in, and more. Even in science's greatest successes, these social values are a motivating influence. Einstein's revolutionary theory of physics were in part inspired by his concerns about how to set clocks at different train stations to the same time. In 2006, I attended a talk in which the preeminent evolutionary biologist Richard Levin said that his scientific work begins with the question of what science will do for the children. Our interests and our values are the engine of scientific discovery. Ideological awareness is thus essential to our understanding of science. The failure to recognize the pervasive influence of values on science is a danger because problematic roles for values can proceed unchecked if their role is not acknowledged. It took decades for the gender bias in medical research I mentioned above to gain recognition, and even longer for any steps to be taken to mitigate it. Just recently, a Hastings report found that a myopic focus on genomics has crowded out research on social determinants of health at a cost to racial equity. Disclosing how values influence science is the first step to analyzing their influence. Ideology cannot be challenged if it remains concealed. It seems what Krauss is criticizing is not actually the role of ideological influence at all, but rather ideological awareness, the recognition of ideological bias. He's right about one thing, though. Periodically, through science's long history, there are abhorrent instances of scientific research going wrong for ideological reasons. This is one reason why we need the humanities. We need philosophers to help lay bare and analyze how values shape science. We need historians to reveal science's broader societal context. What science needs is not a return to ideological obliviousness, but growing ideological awareness, a collective move to uncover the social and political values that influence our scientific research in order to critically evaluate those values and the roles they play. More intentional pursuit of ideological awareness is not a corrupting influence on science, but a shift that will only result in better scientific research and a clearer understanding of the significance of our scientific findings. Wow. Well, that ties in a lot to my approach with this show. I am a science freak. I love science. It is a powerful way that we learn about the world. But I also have ultimate commitments and values that I try to lay bare and make transparent. So if you should disagree and consider them biases of some sort, you can account for them. And of course, I spend most of my time talking about scientific reporting without a whole lot of comment. I sometimes try to add perspective. And of course, I'm the editor. I pick out which stories to read. And I do edit. I often shorten them down just to make it more concentrated, more packed for each minute. So those subjective choices and values that I bring to it influences what the content is that you hear on this show. And like this article says, the point is not to have an ideology. It's to be aware of it and to be transparent, to know about conflicts of interest and be able to adjust for any potential biases. And that's part of the process of science as a scientific community, is by people having debates and being challenged and having power relationships by which people who actually have minority positions are able to air their grievances and be heard. Well, that does it for the greatest hit show number 4, a compilation of stories from earlier episodes. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.